Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to. So I finally got sort of caught up now to the last book that I've finished. There's been three episodes in a row where I've sort of been reviewing them weeks after I finished the book, just because life at the moment is very, very busy back in Berlin working on a new show and just doing lots of different things. It's almost like having a real job, even though I'm only working on this new show for 3 or 4 hours a day. It's sort of taking up a lot of time, and having my girlfriend living with me at the moment. I mean, she has her own apartment, but she's pretty much here all the time, and that takes up more time than being single or living alone or whatever. Two things. Thanks for all the feedback that I've got recently. Thanks for all the emails. I've seen quite a few of them. It seems like even though I put up the episode for The Moat in God's Eye a few days ago, lots of people seem to enjoy that review. A few people disagreeing with my take on it, my low rating of the book. And other people saying, well, I read it years ago, maybe I didn't notice all the racism and stuff in it. So thanks a lot for those emails. If you want to email me about any subject at all, luke@juggler.net is the best way to get hold of me. I do reply to every single email that I get. So keep sending stuff in, keep sending in book recommendations too. The other thing that I want to mention is that there's a new podcast out on the 5x5 network. So let me just bring up this website here. It's called, if you go to 5x5... .tv/IA, you get to the Anatko Almanac. And I just want to mention this podcast because Andy Anatko is one of my favorite sort of podcasting kind of internet personalities. Whenever he's a guest on somebody else's podcast, it's always really interesting to hear him go off on tangents about geeky topics and different stories from his life and different stories that he's read in books. He's very good at retelling other stories from books that he's read, or, you know, comics that he's read, or radio shows, or places that he's been to. He's a very good, very interesting storyteller. And so when I found out that he was doing his own podcast, where it was nothing but sort of like ramblings, sort of like the things that would normally be diversions and rabbit holes that you go down onto other shows, this is all of that. So I thought that I'll check this out. And at the end of episode number 5, where he talks about his disability with science fiction novels, because he hasn't read many science fiction novels and he's trying to get into it again, he put a shout out for my podcast that he just discovered after, well, I emailed him about some science fiction novels that you should check out, and he obviously checked out this podcast. So thanks a lot for mentioning that, and I thought I would just do the same thing and mention that podcast, because it's a good sort of wide range of geeky topics that you're interested in there, and other topics which I'm not interested in. Like, I don't really care about comic books, but listening to Andy talk about the new DC comic books is actually very interesting. And him talking about the flea markets, the MIT flea markets that he's been to. What other episodes have we got here? Talking about Roger Ebert's memoir and going to the New York Comic Con. These topics aren't things that I would normally consume myself, but listening to someone who's good at talking about something can make it very interesting. So that's my podcast recommendation. A few episodes ago, me and Jesse and Tama did a podcast recommendation. So even that's not about science fiction books, there was one episode about science fiction books where I think that he talked more about non-science fiction books and science fiction non-books, like a movie, more than anything else. Anyway, let's get on to today's episode. Today's review, this episode's review, I think is the words I'm trying to say. Today I'm going to be reviewing a fantasy book called Spellwright by Blake Charlton. And I have the Goodreads page up here. It was published May 2010. I think there's the another one came out. The follow-up to this book came out. Let me just check on Amazon. So, there's also Spellbound. So there's Spellbound and Spellwright. Spellwright is the first book. Spellbound is the second book. So I'm guessing, obviously, at the end of this book, you do realize that it's going to be a series, but this is a standalone novel. If you just want a standalone fantasy novel, you can read this one and be satisfied. There's not, when you get to the end, and nothing makes sense until you read the next book. So that's a good thing about this. So, and it's about, how many pages? I've got the book in front of me here. Not an audiobook this time. This was a paperback, 470 pages long, roughly. And then a cover is a nice thing with lots of these different runes on, like your sort of like your elven script from your Tolkien book. It looks a little bit like that. And if it's about writing spells, I'm guessing that's why that cover looks like it is. So it says on the front, a letter perfect story, absorbing by Robin Hobb. And on the back it says, one of the few truly original magical systems we've seen in fantasy fiction by Tad Williams. Yeah. That's what the book is. Pretty nice book. So getting into it, the world of the book is set in a place. Oh, there's a map at the front. Now, what I always do is I always never look at the map in the front until I have finished reading the book, and then I'll go back and see if the book has what am I trying to say? Has described the world in a way that I didn't need to look at the book again. And now I'm looking at this map, and I have no idea where I'm looking at. So actually, you don't really need to look at the map at the front of the book at all, but it's a fantasy book, so there's going to be one on here. So all of the action takes place in this land where magic is well known, and there used to be two continents. And there was an old continent where all the gods were, and the demons were, and the elves were, and all the magical beings were. And then the humans decided to leave that place and leave behind the gods, and there was this big cataclysm, and they went across to a new world, a new continent, and there's no way back at all. Once you've gone from one place to the other, you can't come back. So the humans live in a sort of human-dominated world. There were other races there and stuff like that, but generally all of those have died out now. And these other races left behind big towers and whole cities, and the humans come in and they use those same cities and all those kind of things as their own, so that's pretty cool. So a lot of this action takes place in this one big sort of magician's school. Well, not so much a school, but it's a it is a school, but it's much more than that. It's like an administration center for magicians, and magicians do have quite a bit of power in the world, and seem to sort of work through things politically, because magic is very powerful in this book, and everyone knows in this world, and everyone knows that the magic exists. So it's used for battles, and then there's this thing: okay, we're not allowed to use magic as any kind of war. So the magicians are constantly brokering peace between different factions, between different kingdoms, and things like that. And what will happen is that the different royal families and different high-born people, they'll send their people to the magic school. I'm just trying to find in the book here what the name of the Starhaven. That was it. So Starhaven is where all the action takes place. Now, also within this world, I'll talk a little bit more about the magicians. When you are born a magician, you have this certain innate ability, but you can never give birth to another magician. So magicians, it's not a hereditary thing in that way. It's like an anti-hereditary condition. So each time a magician comes in, they stay there for life, they grow old, and they die within Starhaven. Or there was another one, Astrofell, which is another place, and there was another few of these different sort of centers of magic around the different world here. I look at the map now, there's Lorne and Dral and Spikes and Verdant and Trillian and Ixos. You know, these are the different kingdoms around, but like I say, I don't need to worry too much about them. That's the kind of political setup. So this Starhaven itself is lots and lots of towers with lots of bridges between the towers, and it isn't, like I say, isn't built by humans, but is being maintained by humans, and all the people there are training to be magicians. Even though they have some magic talent, they've got to be able to get this sorted. So what happens is that there is a prophecy. I'm getting onto sort of a bit more plot wise here. There is a prophecy that someone will rise up, and they will become this prophetic leader, and they will be able to command this and that. In fact, I can't actually remember exactly what the prophecy is going to be, but there's a good prophecy and there's a bad prophecy, and then somebody else has another bad prophecy that this person is going to rise up and they're going to be like the Antichrist, if you will. So they're not going to save everyone, they're not going to be the most powerful magician, they're going to disrupt everything. And other people say, well, we've got to look for the prophet, and we've got to create the prophet, and other people are going, no, we've got to destroy destroy the prophet, because it's as soon as the prophet comes up, then the anti-prophet is going to come up, and he's going to do that. Well, not the prophet, the savior, the messiah. So there's people who have been prophets, and now this is going to be a messiah that rises up, and then there's going to be the anti-messiah. And that's sort of like the basis of some of the tension at the beginning, because we find our hero, Nicodemus, some people think that he is the messiah, and some people think that he might be the anti-messiah, and other people think other things. Some people think, well, he's nobody because he's not good enough to be either, and he has this disability, so he can't be either, he's not pure. Oh, and he has this mark on the back of his neck, which looks a bit like this rune, but actually it's sort of misspelt and it means something else now. And so there's a big confusion. So Nicodemus Wheel, who is the sort of, I think he's like the bastard son of some duke somewhere, and he was sent away. You get some of his backstory, and you find out that he does have connections, royal connections, and he does have a whole backstory there, which we do get little bits and pieces of as well. So the setup of the story is that now Nicodemus, young guy, well, he's sort of like we're told that he's young, but he's actually like 25 or 30 or something, so not that young. But wizards live to a very, very, very old age. Normal people in this book live to a normal age, but we don't meet many of these normal people. We only meet the people who live to an old age. So we meet some people and they're called young and they're actually 40, and then we meet some people and they're sort of, oh well, he's sort of middle aged and he's 120, and I guess you can live for a long, 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 long time. So that's pretty cool. What was I going to say? Oh yeah, so he's young and he's trying to get over a disability. Now, the best thing for me to do is skip to the way that the magic works in this book, because this is the sort of the biggest chunk of this book, or the biggest idea in this book, is how the magic system works. And as we see, Tad Williams at the back says, one of the few truly original magic systems we've seen in fantasy fiction. So let me just talk a little bit about this. Everything is about writing spells. And when you write a spell, you sort of cast it out into the world and it sort of floats in its writing. So you sort of write the letters somehow, like in the arms, in the muscles of your arms, and you sort of write it and sort of hold it in your hand in a kind of magical way, and then you cast it into the world, and then those words will go and do something. And it could be something very simple, I will write. In fact, there's a little bit here. I folded the corner over here, so it goes. It says, find Nicodemus's ear and sound a sick donkey farting. So it's just a very, like, find and do this and then do this. When this happens, then do that. So it's a very, very simple sentence. But you can get bigger and bigger and bigger and more complex spells to get to the point where it's like, well, in this situation, we want to do this and this and this, and we want a tool that does that. So first I'll write this tool and I'll write it in this language, and then I'll write this other tool and write it in this language, and I'll combine them together and I'll get something which does this. And you're like, great, that's pretty cool. And then you write, so then there's like, oh, okay, we're going to have, like, I'm going to write a, I was going to say a computer program. I was going to write a spell which is so complex that it actually follows through stuff. So it's like a little robot, or a little, like, a thing that I can, you know, be, that I can control as, and I'll shape it into like a rabbit so it can run and do this for me. It can run and deliver this message, because I need it to be able to navigate stuff. So I'll create a message body, and then I'll create a delivery system and put them together and it can do that. Or I'm going to create this gargoyle, and this gargoyle is going to keep watch from people. Or I'm going to create this monster, and this monster is going to be a fighting monster, and I'm going to create this, and that's going to be my companion. Or I'm going to do this, and it's going to help me spy on things. There's these different levels of intelligence, or different levels of complexity that they can write into the spells, and then when they set them out into the world, they do different jobs, which is pretty cool. Now, I've already said that this sounds a little bit like a sort of like writing a computer program and then running it on a computer. So this is one of the things that I liked about the book, but then I thought was a bit strange, that people saying one of the truly original magical systems we've seen in fantasy fiction. It is kind of original to see it in fantasy fiction, but this is it seems very, very much copied almost directly from The Matrix. Because in The Matrix, when you see that sort of green text on the black background, and then they zoom out, and then they zoom out, and they zoom out, you realize that the whole world is created with text. The whole world is created with this different languages, with this different codes. And what we see dribbling down the screen in The Matrix, and that famous kind of Matrix screensaver that everyone had on their computer in 1999 or whenever it was, Once you see that, you're like, ah, okay, so that's what's going on here. And in the Matrix, they go and find the librarian, and they go and find the key finder, no, the key maker, and they go and find these guys, and these guys are demons, and these, well, it's not like a demon, which is a computer code, which is just executing this script here, and you get these people who are actually real people living in the Matrix, and these people aren't real people, they're just computer codes, but you can't really tell the difference, but one of them will be intelligent, and one of them won't, and one of them will actually be alive and another one won't be alive, and one and so we're getting very much a sort of like a system like that. But and like I say here, we even got like I said, this bit, simple John cast find open square bracket Nicodemus's ear close square bracket and sound in capital letters open bracket a sick donkey farting close bracket full stop. So we're actually getting examples of code that you would write down. It's like, okay, well, how am I going to write this script? And you would go, well, I need to do this, and then I need to do that, and go like that. And I'm like, great, well, that's that. You're taking the analogy of computer programming and bringing it out into the real world to the point where you're actually getting sample scripts, sample spells, which could look like computer scripts. And then it doesn't just go there, because then there's different languages. So there's one something that only idiots can use, which will be something like, you know, basic 10, do this, 20, print this, 30, go to 10. You know, it's that kind of stuff. And then there's a little bit higher level languages, which could be something, you know, which you learn when you're starting out, or something like Python, which is useful for some things. And then you get these different level of, I mean, I don't know a lot about different levels, but then you can, there's these things that sound very much like JavaScript. And then there's other things which sound more like C. And then more when you go into it, more assembly language. And there's one thing that I realized right away. I thought, oh, well, this is going to be great, because when you get going to get down to it, we're going to see what that the level of the universe, we're going to get down to that final base level script, which I guess in computers would be like the hardware itself, or, you know, the actual wires connecting them together, but otherwise maybe assembly language or whatever runs on the in the base in the guts of the you know, once you've compiled it down to some language, what is that base language that you're compiling down to? I thought, oh, that's what we're going to see. And then they said something about, oh, it's going to have like only 4 characters. And I said, oh, that's DNA then. And then, of course, later on in the book, mild spoiler, we realize that one of these base languages is very much like DNA. So taking the sort of like encoding information and then using that information and doing this and doing that and manipulating that information in different languages is very much like what we have in the real world in computers, all the way from the language of DNA that is in all life, all the way up to, you know, like the very like HTML kind of not even a computer language, just a formatting language, and then up to the very most basic one, which is like, I get a pen, I write something down, and it's in normal English. Although I don't know the, you know, what would it be? Lornish or something like that, Dralish, whatever the language is that these people are spelling in at the moment. So this, I thought, could be really, really interesting. And it is kind of really, really interesting, because he's taking this idea, and sure, it's original to apply these kind of levels, but then, unfortunately, Blake Charlton isn't that good at writing this. And a lot of the time, we're just told what he is using. You're sort of like, okay, and then he used this language, and it's impossible to spell in this it's impossible to misspell in this language, because if you misspell anything, the language is not logically consistent and won't even exist. It's sort of like self-nullifying if you don't spell it exactly right, so you have to spell it exactly right, otherwise it doesn't work at all. And he's like, oh, great, so let's have an example of that. Go on, let's have an example. And there's no examples. And I thought this was a bit strange, because I really wanted to see examples of like, oh, to create this thing, I need to take this part and 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 this part. I thought this would be really good, because Blake Charlton can show us the kind of things that you can do when you go, well, I'm going to take this element of this language and this element of this language, and I'm going to combine them. And, you know, one of the characters could do this, and then something could happen in a way that you think you know the rules to this language, or you think you know the rules of how to combine these two languages. And when it works out, like in the story, it can work, or they can discover a new rule, or the rules can break in any way like that. But no matter how many different languages Blake Charlton describes, no matter how many languages that the different characters use, they might as well all be the same, because all he does is describe what the languages are. He says what they do, but he never actually gives these rules of the language. He never says, well, Magus language is like this, and Spirish language is like this, and Python language is like this, and we're going to combine them together to do this. And then you're going to go, ah, I know how this spell is going to work. No, he just says, ah, and this character spelt this in this language and did that in that language, and then he made this spell. And I'm like, well, why are you even going into all this depth about the different languages that are going to be used if, in the end of it, all that comes out is a spell that does this? And maybe I'm not explaining this right, but if all it's going to be is, if the only thing that matters is the result of the spell, and that is pretty much all what does matter through the vast majority of this book, we get a huge amount of info dumping about how the spells work, and how they are cast and how they are done and what they have to think about and what they know and the history of this language and the history of this language. And all it comes up to, it might as well say, for the purposes of the story and the purposes of the, you know, the plot and the characters, it might as well just say, he cast a spell that did this. Yeah, and that's what I really liked about The Matrix, is that when we got to the point where there is somebody actually looking at the text, isn't it Cyrus or whatever, isn't it Silas, his name? And he's got these three screens in front of him, and there's a green text coming down them. And we know that he's doing something bad in these things, but then Neo comes up to us like, oh, what are you doing? And he says, oh, well, you know, all I see is blonde and brunette and redhead. So he just says, oh, well, you know, I'm just looking at this pawn here, and I'm seeing the green text coming down here. But you, as the character, Neo, you don't see anything, and I'll just say, oh, I'm just watching porn. And the people at home, they know he's not watching porn, they know he's doing something bad. Mild spoilers for The Matrix. But we know that him just saying, oh, I'm just doing this, is good enough. We don't need to know, well, this character on this screen, this little green letter here, that means that. And over here, it looks exactly the same. It's another green character, but it's in a different language, and that means that. And oh, over here, we've got this. And now the history of this little green character is this. We don't need that. Just cut to the chase. Just go, well, I'm going to go into this virtual world, and it's going to look awesome. And we're going to do this, and we're going to do this. When Neo says, I can do kung fu. We see him doing the kung fu in cool ways. We don't get 8 or 9 pages of someone saying, now, to download the kung fu brain module, we have to do this, and we have to do this, and we have to... We don't. We just see someone loading up a disc going, kung fu, and they just put it in, learn kung fu. And when they flash through, it's like, yes, you can do judo, you can do karate. And one of the things that flashes up on the screen, it just says drunken brawl or pub brawl or something like that. Though that's one of his kung fu skills that gets downloaded into Mr. Anderson, into Neo. And I like that little thing. So we could have had a lot less exposition about the languages and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, we do get a lot of info dumping. Let's just get onto some of the... I'm going to come back more to the story, but just to say about the info dumping, a lot of it happens in a way that, oh, we do this, oh, and we do that. And at one point, someone says, you know, I never took theology either. You know, it says, but you memorize everything Shannon says. And he says, okay, all right. And then Nicholas just repeats an entire, what, 3-4 pages or something of a lecture that he heard once, and then he just repeats it. And I'm like, really, that's what we're going to do here? At another point, there's this all this interesting stuff that's happening, interesting stuff, and then, you know, one, he goes, Nicholas, you really got to teach this lesson. He's like, oh, do I? He's like, yeah, you've got to go and teach this lesson. So in the middle of this story, we're going, okay, story, la, 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 info dumps, blah, 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 and then we just go, okay, and now Nicholas is going to teach a lesson to a class, and we're going to be in the lesson with him. He's never taught a lesson before. This is the first lesson he's ever taught, and then he never teaches another lesson again, but we just have this. And I'm like, really, we don't need this kind of stuff. And we don't just get the info dumps on the on the spelling system and the magic system and things like that. We get a lot of info dumping on the history of things, and a lot of it is done in a sort of like, as you know, this kind of thing. Right near the beginning of the book, I can't remember what it says, but someone says, you know, hey, do you know this guy? Oh, is that the guy who does this? This? Oh, yeah, I've actually found it here. I am Magister Shannon's apprentice, he said. Magister Agru Shannon, the famous linguist, the expert on textual intelligence? The same. And I'm like, okay, so if you know who someone is, you don't ask, like, I am Magister Shannon's apprentice, he said. And then someone else asks, this guy, the famous linguist, the expert on textual analysis, you just, if you'd have just said, I am Master Shannon's apprentice, and he said, Master Agru Shannon? And he would have gone, that's the guy. It's like, if you know the name and it's the name of the guy. You don't then need to list all of the things that he's expert about and intelligence in and famous for. As the narrator, you can do that, and you can do it in the story, but why do we have all these characters like explaining stuff to each other that literally they both know? He is the apprentice of Agu Shannon, so we don't have to say Agu Shannon, the famous linguist, the expert on textual intelligence. You know, that kind of thing happens all the way throughout the book as well. And also, to talk about some of the spells, now, I thought... If you remember, I did this review of the Name of the Wind book, and then there was another one, the Wise Man's Fear by someone. I can't remember the guy's name now. And he had this different fighting systems, and I thought it was really clever that he didn't say, oh, and then he struck him with his fist, and then he swept his leg out. He just said, I did this move. It was called the Thousand Temples. And I did this move, which was called the Fluttering Hand, and I did this. And it was really funny that he could tell... He could have two people fighting by naming the moves and by naming the skills that they were doing, by naming the strikes that they were doing, but just in the jargon and then never explaining it. And I thought that was really cool. And then he did it later on in the same book, or was it earlier in the same book, where he talked about two people having sex and they also had the moves. And she did the Thousand Temples on him, and then he returned with the Fluttering Hand. And it was exactly the same kind of... clever wordplay, which the Fluttering Hand could be something sexual or it could be something martial arts wise, and we're just left to sort of fill in the blanks and do that kind of stuff. Later on in this book, we get the similar kind of thing, and we get to know what the spells are called in Spellwright. And you think it's a book all about magic and spells, and it would be really interesting. And he goes, each woman was casting from her waist a white sentence. Oh, when he talks about the spells, everything is like, this is a sentence. It's like a stream of text that does something in the real world. It has some action in the real world. It says, each woman was casting from her waist a white sentence that held a spell book open beside her. This action, called floating a spell book, gave each spellwright quick access to her book's pre-written offensive languages. So I'm saying, okay, the spell, which is where you float a spell book beside you, is called floating a spell book. I mean, can't it be called something like... and of course, he puts that in there because then later on, another character floats a spellbook, and he just said he floated a spellbook, which meant that he had the book floating beside him. I'm like, oh, come on. You already explained what it is. Why don't you just call it like floating the spellbook could be sort of like called something like this action called at the ready, or it's called lightning hand or lightning response, because it's right there next to you and you can just do something really quickly. And then later on, the character could have said he was ready in lightning response, or, you know, ready with a lightning response, which meant that he had a floating spell book beside him. But it's like Blake Charlton doesn't have enough confidence in his own sort of naming and descriptive stuff, that the stuff that he names is what he does. So it's like they do this, he casts this sentence, he casts this paragraph, he casts this, and it's all lots and lots of talking about, like, the names of stuff is very technical. It's very sort of like dry language, which is a real pity, because there was a lot of magic in this book, and I wish it had a little bit more flavor. I wish the different languages, like the different magic languages, had a little bit more distinctiveness, distinctions between them in terms of naming and flavors that you actually see, rather than just going, well, this magic is good for this and this magic is good for that. So that's a lot about the magic, but this book is mostly the magic. To bring it back to the plot, we do have around about two-thirds of the book is backstory, and it's the first two-thirds of the book, backstory and filling us in on how the magic story works. And then from around about page 250, say, onwards, that is maybe a bit later than 250. That is when the story starts kicking in. The things really start doing stuff. You know, the pieces start interlocking, and then you're like, oh, I see why this character was introduced there. This is because they're going to be doing this now. And then they do. And other times it's like, oh, that was interesting. I didn't see that coming. But there's nothing surprising happens in the first two-thirds of this book. It's purely filling us in on the magic system and filling us in on the history of the continent and the history of the politics and the history of the theology and the history of the different factions that are sort of maneuvering in this point as well. So once the story got going, I just read this thing straight through to the end, but I started it and then put it down and then picked it up again and did a bit more and then read it, and I took it on my trip to America and I read bits and pieces of it here and there, but I was a bit distracted then. But once I actually got to that last third of the book, it just streamed by because there was stuff happening. Up until then, the bad guy drops in and drops out and drops in and drops out and drops. And every time he turns up, he does something. And he, it's funny because every time he turns up into Starhaven, where this where all of it's set, it's like, oh no, I'm here, but I can't actually do anything. I can't cast any spells here. I'm not magic inside the walls because of the magic spells that are already in here. And I thought it was interesting that he was like always working on the periphery and always doing things by sort of like at a long distance, like from outside Starhaven up, which is strange because then up until the end he's just like, oh no, I can come in now, and you're like, wait a second, before you couldn't come in and now you can. It wasn't really well explained, and there's a few other little plot holes in it, but generally once you get to that last third it really picks up, which reminds me of the book Old Man's War by John Scalzi, I think it was. Like, the first two-thirds of it are just setting up the world, are just setting up the different weapons that they're using, are setting up how someone becomes an old man warrior, and all that kind of stuff. And then the story kicks off in the last third, and of course, that's the first book in the series, and this is the first book in the series. So I think as the series continues on, hopefully he doesn't try and introduce any more complexity. He just keeps going at the same rate as the plot did in the last third of this book, and it seems like it will do that in the later books, which I'll probably read the second book, because now I'm sort of, I know what's going on with the spelling. So, into the character. Talk about the characters here. Nicholas is our main character. He's pretty much the only guy I want to talk about. The other characters are sort of a bit, I mean, he's the most complex character. The other characters that you think they're going to be complex, and they are in some ways, but really it is just about Nicholas Wheel. And as I was reading this, there was this one really good part where Nicholas said, I was dyslexic as a child and I could never read. And then my nanny, she read to me a book, which was this sword and sorcery book, or this, what does he call them? Knights and swords book. And she read me the first half and then she wouldn't read me the second half of the story. And I was like, well, what happens on? And she says, oh, well, you'll have to read it to find out. And so then he taught himself, Nicholas Wheel taught himself how to read, by reading these knights and dragons stories that he really liked as a child. And as I read that, I thought, I bet you anything, that is exactly what Blake Charlton did. Blake Charlton, the writer of this novel, was I think I heard that he was dyslexic himself. And this book is about this. Nicholas is a magician who the magic is based on spelling things, and he's dyslexic, which is really, that's what it says on the book. You know, it says Nicholas Wheel is trained at the Stronghold of Starhaven, learning how to write spells in his muscle made from luminescent magical runes. Initially, he showed great promise. There was one problem. Nicodemus couldn't spell. And it says here he couldn't spell. And I thought, oh, he's dyslexic. And so that's what I thought. And then it says at the back of the book, page 468, about the author. Blake Charlton first overcame severe dyslexia in the sixth grade when he began sneaking fantasy and science fiction books into his special ed study hall. So yeah, it's exactly, and that is what makes this character good, is because I think this is the first novel. I think it's his first novel. Oh yeah, it says right at the very beginning, Spellwright is his first novel. So you can tell that he is basing a lot of the struggles that Nicodemus goes through in this book on his own struggles as someone who is severely dyslexic as a child. And that is great, because it really does flesh out the character in a good way, and in the ways that he just can't do things, and he sees something and he's never sure, even when he checks it, even when he thinks through something letter by letter, he's never quite sure if he is... it's going correctly or not, or if what's right or not, and when he spells something in one way. And I thought, this is going to be great, and it was great, and this is quite an interesting way of looking at it. However, one trick that I think he missed a bit with this is that there's a term for people who become magicians, who have this magical gene, who can manipulate and see this magic and can learn these different languages. And like I said before, only a few people can learn all those languages. Only a few people are born into it. It's like a hereditary thing. Oh, it's like you can't control it. You can't go, oh, well, I'm going to become a magician. You're either born to it or not. And I thought it would be really great if I presumed that he was going to be the first person who's ever had this dyslexic condition when it comes to spelling. I thought, you know, spelling spells is what I'm trying to say. And that's what I thought it would be. But it turns out right at the very beginning that he isn't just the only guy. He isn't the first person who is dyslexic. He isn't the first dyslexic magician there's ever been. There's actually loads of them, and they've got a long history. And he's just one in a long line of being a dyslexic speller. And I thought the book was going about, he was going to be the first ever, but it seems to be a problem that people know about, and there's already rules in place to stop him touching other people's spells and misspelling other people's spells and things like that. So that was one thing that I thought he missed. Now, bringing it back, tying back in with Nicholas's disability back into this magic system. Again, I really do think Blake Charlton missed a trick here, because I thought it would be like if we'd have actually used examples of the spell, and then he could have cleverly, once Nicodemus tries to do the same spell and misspells something, I thought we would see the result of that misspelling. Say, set. The word set has many, 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 many different reasons. Like, so if you said, could you set that drink down over there? No, this is the same spellings. But, you know, the same kind of thing. So if you set the drink over there, it could be like, okay, you pick it up and put it down over there, or you could put it up and put it over there and then let it set so it goes hard or settle, you know, in all these different meanings of the word set. I should have written down some examples of this. I'm trying to think of words which have more than one meaning with a slight different like the word to, do this to that, and it could be like do this and then to that, so it doesn't do it to that, it does it to it does it, and then something else, it creates two of them. So the misspelling two and two could create two of something, rather than something being the subject or object, or, you know, mess it, like, get the grammar, mess up the grammar somehow, mess up different words somehow, and see what comes out the other end. I thought that's what this book would be, and that's why I was really looking forward to, like, reading it as a real book, not as an audio book, and I would be able to see this wordplay and see all these different things. And I think at one time, it's kind of references one real spelling mistake that does it. But most of the rest of the time, all of the spelling mistakes just go, he tried to do this and he failed because he spelt it wrong. And he tried to do this and he failed because he spelt it wrong. And he tried to do this and he failed because he spelt it wrong. And he created this word, and because there was this thing, it failed because he spelt it wrong. And I wanted to see those mistakes of spelling, and I wanted to see how those mistakes of spelling played out in the real world. Like, well, not in the real world, but in the world around Nicodemus and Shannon, his master, and these other people who he interacts with. I really wanted to see more of that. And at one point, we're talking about like taking the programming and computer systems analogy through into the real world, not into the real world, into the world of this book, and into like a fantasy world. At one point, he visits Google, and you could say, oh, visits Google. Well, that's what happens. He goes to the library of the Starhaven, but the library has this thing called the index, and the index isn't just an index of what's in the library. It can go out and it crawls all of the. It has these little web crawling things which go through all of the different web pages. I mean, spell books in the entire place, in the entire internet. I mean, in the entire of Starhaven. And then all you need to do is put in a request, and it gives you back the answer without you having to search through every page one by one yourself. Which is, it's like you was visiting Google HQ, or the Google server find. Back in the days, I remember I'd listened to an audiobook of a book called I'm Feeling Lucky, and it was all about the stories or the memoirs of Google employee number 59. I can't remember who wrote it now. You can check on goodreads.com for that. You can see my review there. And it was interesting when they were saying, oh yeah, we were indexing the web, we're indexing the whole thing, and we wanted an index with a billion web pages. We're going to index a billion web pages. That was the big goal, index a billion web pages. And that's the kind of thing that we see in this book. And Nicholas goes in and he starts fiddling with the... they're going into test. At one point the plot stops because they've got to go in and do a test on the index to see how it works, because it's this ancient artifact which they don't really know how it works, and they've got to go in and hack into it to see what the source code is, or to see what, you know, what kernel it's running. And they do that, and I thought, well, it's going to be great because Nicodemus is going to touch this spell book and it's going to misspell everything in the index. And now every time someone casts a spell to turn something into... every time they cast a spell, they actually cat a spell. So nobody casts spells anymore. They cat spells, or cats spells. So every time they do a spell, thousands of cats turn up. And I thought that's what we're going to get. I thought we were going to get a real exploration of breaking grammar, of breaking spelling, of getting one spell, misspelling one word or swapping two words around as you would do if you were dyslexic, and then see what would pop out the other end. Do one that involves numbers, and he misquotes a number, and then instead of getting 1,000 things, you get like 10,000 things, or instead of getting one things, you know, you get pi things. You know, all these different directions that the book could have gone in, which I expected it to do. It didn't go in, so I was a little bit disappointed about that. That's a bit more. What else do I want to talk about here? Normally I talk about the themes of the book, but really the theme of this book is, hey, check it out, computers. Imagine if they were magic, right? And in the end, I'm thinking, well, it must be that all of this is taking place within some kind of Matrix universe. Everything, when you get down to the base of it, and you get down to the bottom of the world, there's not going to be some kind of Planck length, which is imponderable. You're going to get down to it, and you're going to see that, oh, wait a second, this is running a little bit of code over here. Oh, and this is running a bit of code over here. And we do get that kind of stuff. So that's pretty much where I'm going to leave this review, I guess. If you're going to be writing a book about dyslexia, I really wanted a book. The experience of someone going through dyslexia is portrayed very well. Let me put it that way. But it didn't give me the experience of being dyslexic. And I think if Blake Charlton was a better writer, we could have got that. We could have experienced what it was like to be dyslexic, like from on a first-hand point of view, like when we see a word. And he did do that in one time where he wrote a thing and he was like, oh, I'm reading this language and it says this. And he's looking at it and says, I can't see anything wrong. And I was like, oh, look, he spelt two words wrong in that sentence. But then he doesn't mention it. So maybe, I don't know, maybe Blake Charlton put loads and loads of incorrectly spelt words throughout this entire book, but I didn't notice them. And maybe that's what it's like to be dyslexic, but I reckon it would have been cool if at one point he'd have just done like a full chapter written in the voice of Nicodemus. It's like, okay, and then here is his paper that he handed in, and we have to read it. This is one of the genius things about Flowers for Algernon by Daniel Keyes. And he starts writing as though someone is severely mentally challenged, is severely dyslexic, and then he goes through and he starts writing what it's like to be, if you're an amazing writer, amazing thinker, and he uses all the words and he constructs his narratives within each chapter perfectly, and each sentence is a perfectly weighted sentence with three different parts, and it's great, and then he goes back through and becomes an idiot again, and we lose all of that stuff. I wanted this book to be that. I wanted it to be that clever. Or in the book, is it Fearsome Engine by Ian M. Banks? I think that's what it's called. Like every third chapter is told from the point of view of someone spelling phonetically. And it takes like 2 minutes to get, like two pages to get into it. And you think, oh, I'm never going to be able to read this. And once you get into it, you just read it and you don't need to think about it. And I'd have loved to have seen a book about dyslexia, which was as clever, in a set in a magical spelling, which was as clever as say something like Flowers for Algernon. Which is a big thing to aim for, and I just don't think Blake Charlton is capable of that. So all of the things about this book, I'm not saying that this book is a bad book at all. I enjoyed the book. The story was okay. I haven't gone into the story very much at all here. I could talk about like what I don't like about prophecies in most fantasy books and science fiction books. Like there's a prophecy and it's going to happen, and you're like, well, why is it going to happen? And there is one book which I love where there's a prophecy, and that is Dune, because you realize very, very quickly on, very early on in the book, that it's not really a prophecy which is mystical. It's a prophecy that there's this whole big group of people, the Bene Gesserit, whatever you call them, working towards this. And there's this thousand, you know, generation plan that they're aiming to sort of build the Kwisatz Haderach, the Messiah that they're actually building towards. And they mess up and they get there one generation too early. So that was one way of doing it. And there is something, I wouldn't say there's something similar in this, but what I really like about this book with the prophecy is that there's lots of different prophecies and they're all prophesying against each other. This one thinks that this one's going to happen, this one thinks that this is going to happen. And that's the great thing about, say, prophecy in the Bible compared to the prophecy in the in the Quran compared to the prophecy in the Book of Mormon, if there isn't. I'm not quite sure what prophecies there are. But there's all these conflicting ones, and everyone's working toward their own goals, and everyone's preparing for the prophecy to come true as they think the prophecy is going to come true, and they're sort of neglecting others. And I really like that about Spellwright. There's lots of stuff in this book that I do enjoy. I like how the theology of it and the history of the two countries. I haven't gone into any of this. Not the two countries, the two continents. I haven't gone into any of that because I want to leave all of that for you guys to find, and I really enjoy the different creatures that you get in there. And I've avoided a lot of the stuff which is good about this book and that you will enjoy about this book, but I had some preconceived notions about what this book would be like, and I was disappointed in many ways when those things weren't fulfilled, when he didn't do these things that I was talking about. Which is a real pity, because now I would love to read the book which I want to read. I would love someone to say, hey, imagine there's all of these different magic systems which are sort of based on the different qualities of programming systems on computers, and when you get down to the fine level of it, you're going to find DNA, and when you do this and you do that, it's all going to be cool like that. And we're going to get someone who misspells stuff and makes mistakes, and we're going to have examples, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do that. And I just think that book would be great, but now nobody's going to write that book because everyone's going to say, hey, wait a second, you're just copying Blake Charlton. And I'd say, no, they're copying Blake Charlton, but they're doing it better. They're doing how I wanted to do to see it. I want the examples. I want the examples of misspellings and mistakes, and just the examples of spells that have worked well, and just work it through logically. And there is obviously some kind of logic behind that what we see in Blake Charlton. But he only goes halfway. I would much rather it just be a story with some magic and some fantasy, and all we get is the I just see blonde, brunette, and redhead, like it is in The Matrix. We just see the result of it. Or I want to see it, all of the gritty details of the languages, but like say Blake Charlton goes halfway through and we get a lot of details, but not enough for the details to be interesting. And we do get a lot of the results, but a lot of the results are sort of hampered by the massive amounts of info dumping about spells, where it doesn't really matter too much about how it works. You know, there's this thing, there is in this book, there is a logical language where you can't misspell this logical language, and I'd love to see some examples of that language compared to other languages, like how maybe it's like Latin, where it does, like the word order doesn't really matter because each word that you use, it says if it's the object, if it's the subject, and you can't get it mixed up. Like if you say dog chases man chases dog in Latin, I don't know Latin, but apparently it doesn't matter which way round, that you could say dog man chase dog chase man, you know, man dog chase man dog. It doesn't matter which way round it goes because it always comes out correct, and that meaning can get across no matter which order that you put the words in. I think, I really don't know enough about Latin to be sure. But yeah, what is the logical language which can't be misspelled? Because if you get one of those words wrong, you're sort of like dog men could both be objects, and then eat, and you know, like, well, or chase, and what are dogs and men chasing? You know, that could be a cool way to just mess up, that you get like two subjects wrong and you're not quite sure what the object is. Maybe you say dog man chases, and you think you've cast the spell wrong, but you've got the chases in the wrong way. It should be between the two words, and then you do another spell which starts cats eat food. And in the end, that cats goes on to the beginning, the end of the last spell. You know, I'm just coming up with ideas in my head. I haven't even worked these out on paper. And I thought that's what I was going to get out of this book. So I was disappointed when I didn't. I think I've gone on long enough. Read this book. I'm going to give it 3 stars. Now that you're warned what this book isn't, you'd probably enjoy it more. Some of the characters, like that. But really, just read the book. It's pretty good. I'm going to give it 3 stars because I was disappointed. But it is a solid book. I'll probably read the second one in this series because it did convince me that there is talent here. I just now I'm warned for the second book that I know kind of which direction the second book will go. So that's it, 3 stars. The next book that I'm going to review is going to be Spin by Robert Charles Wilson. It's the first time I've read this book, one of the most recommended books by SFBRP listeners. I'm really enjoying it a lot. There's some books that I read to make me fall asleep or to help me sleep that I read until I fall asleep. And there's other books which I read and they keep me awake. And Spin by Robert Charles Wilson is definitely a book which I read and I have to close it myself. I don't read it until I fall asleep and it falls closed. despite my intentions. It stays open and I stay reading it despite my intentions. So that's the next book. You can follow me on goodreads.com/Luke Burridge. Become my friend. Follow my reviews. You can also, I can see what you think about this book. For example, I can see here, friends reviews. 12 people of my friends, are probably SFBRP listeners, have reviewed Spellwright by 3.67 stars average of the 12 people I reviewed it, and it's got a 3.6. Yeah, so I would call this, if I didn't know what this book is, I'd probably call it a 3. Like, if I wasn't disappointed in the way that I thought, I didn't realize I was going to be disappointed, I'd say about 3.5 stars. That disappointment knocked it down to 3 stars for me. But yeah, I'd say this is a 3.5 star book. Mark Chitty rated it 5 stars. Who else is here? Membry Lou rated it 3 stars. But his he writes in Spanish, which I can't do. Simcha Lazarus, 3 stars. You know, so there's it's generally a range of 3 to 5 star books. So that's pretty good. There's nobody hates it. It doesn't seem like, but I don't think it's going to become a classic. So yeah, and if you put your own review here on this page or reply to my review, I can read your review and see what you think of the book as well. That's great stuff. Otherwise, email me, luke@juggler.net. Check out my blog, and you can do that at lukeburridge.com/blog. And you can also check out my own books that I write, my own novels. Not books, they're novels, because they're not actually bits of paper. You can find that at lukeburridge.com/fiction.html. And finally, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm @LukeBurridge on Twitter, and I do post on Twitter about the books that I'm reading and the SFBRP. Otherwise, if you care about my life as a juggler, you can become my friend on Facebook. Just tell me that you're an SFBRP listener so I know who you are, and it doesn't just like some random people asking to be my friends there. So, but mostly on Facebook, I just talk about juggling and life stuff, not so much about science fiction. I do that on Goodreads and on Twitter. So that's it. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.